The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Glorious day outside here at Edstone. Bright sunshine all over the place. I think it's about 45 degrees Fahrenheit, so still a little bit chilly, but just a beautiful day. Lots of the birds are out. I saw a couple of new varieties this morning. I think I have the name of one later on in my notes if we have time. And then another one I'll have to do some research on, a beautiful-looking bird, multicolored. So we'll come to that, I suppose, at a later time. The group down in the down in the Alps, I guess, this is their last day of skiing, so they'll be making their way back home tomorrow. And then I might mention, too, over in Edmond, I think tonight or tomorrow is the beginning of the big singles bash, the singles winter weekend. So I'm sure that'll be exciting for a lot of the brethren visiting Edmond, Oklahoma, the headquarters campus for the Philadelphia Church of God. Coming up on the Trumpet Hour today, I might mention too, Joel Hilliker, if an earlier discussion is any indication, I think he's going to be covering the subject of Christmas, which you'll want to stay tuned for after this show ends at the top of the hour. And, of course, if you're not too familiar with the teachings of God's church, you're going to be in for some surprises during Trumpet Hour. On this program, we'll be going back to the foundational knowledge that that we need to understand, as Mr. Armstrong said, the whole movie that is human civilization. So we'll head back to Genesis 4, 5, and 6 and see how much we can get through in the second segment. In this segment, we're going to spend most of our time with a column that Carolyn Glick wrote a few days ago about what Benjamin Netanyahu can learn from Boris Johnson and Donald Trump. And as she brings out in her piece, it really is astounding to just look at the parallels between these three brother nations, Ephraim, Manasseh, and of course, Judah. So we'll spend some time on that here in just a bit. Firstly, though, what are we to make of the North Korean weapons test? I guess there are some saying that some kind of weapons test is imminent, and Richard gave me a piece today by George Friedman, who said that really it doesn't make much sense for North Korea to be, you know, rattling the saber at this particular time. But as Friedman points out in his piece, whenever North Korea ramps up its intensity, its war rhetoric, it's China actually that's working behind the scenes. China's the one that's pushing the buttons. And if you've been watching the news in recent weeks, of course, the U.S. has been applying pressure on China for a better trade deal, and they've had some breakthroughs on that even here recently. But from Friedman's standpoint, or the way that he views it, you can see why China would want to increase tensions between North Korea and the United States so that then China could come in at the last minute and dial it back some, and hopefully have the U.S. then ease off on some of the sanctions and such. In any event, whatever's behind it and however long it will last and whatever might happen over these worldly holidays, the president, for his part, he doesn't seem too concerned about the threat. Here's what he said yesterday, clip one.
We'll see what happens. Well, let's see. Maybe it's a nice present. Maybe it's a present where he sends me a beautiful vase as opposed to a missile test, right? I may get a vase. I may get a nice present from him. You don't know. You never know.
that in response to reports saying that the North Korean leader has a present for the United States, and the president there joking that, well, maybe instead of a missile test, it's a beautiful vase, as he said there. That's the president speaking from Palm Beach just yesterday. Just a quick update here, too, about the deadly protests in Iran. Now, we've covered this story before, but there have been some reports over the last couple of days to show that the crackdown on the ordinary Iranian citizens has been much more severe than was initially reported. According to Reuters, a few days after the protests really ramped up, this is going back, I think, to mid-November, mid to late November, evidently the Ayatollah, he had his top security officials in a meeting, and the Ayatollah told them that basically you need to do whatever it takes to stop the protesters. And so that's then what led to the violent crackdown. And according to Reuters, 1,500 people were killed in the weeks that followed. Not 200 or 300, not 400, but 1,500. It's the bloodiest crackdown since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. That's how severe this is. And so the death toll, as I say, it's much higher than what we previously thought, the initial reports being 200 to 300. This from Reuters yesterday. It says, Iran's interior minister said on November 27th, more than 140 government sites had been set on fire. This is talking about just the extent of the protests. Government sites that have been set on fire, along with hundreds of banks and dozens of petrol stations, while 50 bases used by security forces were also attacked, according to remarks reported by Iran's state news agency, IRNA. It says the minister said up to 200,000 people took part in the unrest nationwide. And so the government then, as I say, cracked down in the severest of ways. 1,500 people, the bloodiest, what did Reuters say? The bloodiest crackdown since the revolution in 1979. Reuters goes on to say here, Iranian authorities deployed lethal force at a far quicker pace from the start than in other protests in recent years, according to activists and details revealed by authorities. It says, just by way of comparison, listen to this. In 2009, when millions protested against the disputed re-election of hardline President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, an estimated 72 people were killed. So going back to the Green Revolution, that was right in the opening months of Obama's administration, you'll recall. 72 people killed, and when Iran faced waves of protests over economic hardships in 2017 and 18, the death toll was about 20 people. So this time around, 1,500. So the sanctions are certainly taking a toll, and there's other factors at play here as well, some of the things that the Iranian government has done. But still, just to finish off here, it says the Mashhar County in the strategically important Khuzestan province, it says Revolutionary Guards in armored vehicles and tanks sought to contain the demonstrations. State TV says security forces opened fire on rioters hiding in the marshes. Reuters says the U.S. State Department has said it has received videos of the Revolutionary Guards opening fire without warning on protesters in Mashhar. So opening fire without warning. So it's a very different direction. Speaking of the United States, when you consider what President Obama was doing on his way out, he was supplying this Islamic regime in Iran with billions and billions of dollars. This same government that's now gunning down its citizens, President Obama was trying to help them. And now you look at the sanctions, it's a different direction for the U.S. now, as the president, President Trump, has ripped to shreds that agreement, the Iran nuke agreement, And he's applied sanctions or reinstated sanctions. Now we know Iran from Bible prophecy, Daniel 11 brings out, but the king of the south is going to push against the king of the north. So somehow or another, they're going to retain power, the mullahs, the ayatollah. But you look at the instability, and just like I said yesterday, when you have a United States superpower that's willing to actually use its power, even economically, like I said yesterday, President Trump, he signs that bill into law, as bloated as it is. But it also really did tighten the screws on that Swiss company helping to build that pipeline. And that company wanted no part of the U.S. sanctions. So it pulled out of that pipeline deal immediately. That shows you the power. If someone's willing to use the power. The Bible says, though, that right at the last, it's going to be, well, we're losing the pride in our power. And that's the kind of leadership, really, that the United States has had before this resurgence. There is no pride in the power of the United States. No willingness to use that power. Well, now you're seeing it happen in some places, like with that pipeline deal and with the sanctions on Iran as well. So what is it that Benjamin Netanyahu, this is from a column by Carolyn Glick, she's one of our favorites, but what is it that Mr. Netanyahu can learn from Boris Johnson and from President Trump? Glick talks about how Netanyahu has been a real revolutionary. He's been in politics for decades there in Israel. And his vision, it sees Israel as a growing regional power. And he's been in office for quite some time as prime minister. And Carolyn Glick talks about how pragmatic he is, how that he picks his battles sparingly, how that when he lacks opportunity to advance his goals, he keeps his head down, and in some ways he'll work in kind of a lateral direction. But then if he has the opportunity, it's very different. She says here, when he can't move forward, Netanyahu operates laterally and so creates new opportunities to push forward when the time is right. So when Obama turned a cold shoulder to both Israel and to the United States' traditional Sunni allies to tilt U.S. Middle East policy towards Iran, that's what happened during the 8 years of Obama. He went from siding with the Sunnis, those in opposition to Iran, to siding with Iran. And so what did put Israel? It put Israel in a difficult position, didn't it? She explains here that when that happened, Netanyahu reached out to the Sunnis, and he actually strengthened ties with some of those Sunni states that were frightened of an Islamic power gaining nuclear weapons, a Shia power. They were just as terrified of Iran, some of those Sunni states, as Israel was. And so during those 8 difficult years with Obama, Netanyahu was reaching out to some of those Sunni states. Well, now it's a very different administration, as I just said. Thanks to the Trump administration, she says, today Netanyahu has the diplomatic opportunity to implement his vision in relation to the Palestinians. Netanyahu set out that vision in the lead up to the inconclusive elections in September. It involves moving past the failed and mordant peace process with the PLO and securing Israel's national and strategic interest in Judea and Samaria by applying Israel law to the Jordan Valley and the Israeli communities in Judea and Samaria. So she's hearkening back to a speech that Netanyahu gave a few months ago in the lead up to the previous elections. That really, it really was a stunning speech. What he was suggesting, what he was proposing. So it was right. I mean, this is like the culmination of his prime ministership. Glick says here, but now that the international path is open, a domestic obstacle has risen to stop him. She's talking about the indictment and the lawyers, the former judges that are after him. The obstacle is an opposing revolution, the judicial revolution initiated by a retired Supreme Court president, Aaron Barak, some 25 years ago. Just as Netanyahu is on the verge of completing his revolutionary work, so the legal fraternity that embraced Barak's revolution is poised to complete Barak's. And so here you have, some would say, two extremes, but really what you have is very similar to what you have in the United States. The more right-wing conservative group that's in power that wants to advance its agenda, and then the radical left that's working to do anything possible to stop it, to get in the way. Glick says that all along, the source of Netanyahu's power has been the voters. So he's going against his own deep state in Israel. And the power behind Netanyahu all along has been the voters. It's just like in the United States with those supporting President Trump. And same with Boris Johnson here in the UK and Brexit. Glick says without their support, the voters that is, he would never have achieved anything. They've got the support of the people. Well, she talks a little bit further about Barak's revolution, the deep state, so to speak, and their quest to destroy Benjamin Netanyahu. And then further on, it says, obviously, Netanyahu's revolution and Barak's revolution cannot coexist in peace with one another. And so, by indicting Netanyahu and inserting the legal fraternity into Israel's political system, as the most powerful decisive force in the country in the midst of Knesset elections, the justices and prosecutors are seeking to complete their seizure of power. The only way to stymie them and restore Israel's democratic system by legislating checks and restraints on their powers is by re-electing Netanyahu with a parliamentary majority. The question is, though, after two consecutive inconclusive elections, is how can Netanyahu pull that off? How can he win? How can he complete his life's work and protect the democratic system that allowed him to undertake it? She says, if you want to know how, you should look at what has happened in the United States and in Great Britain. In Britain, for example, Boris Johnson comes in. He promises to do much better than Theresa May. He puts forward legislation in Parliament. It didn't quite get through. Then he calls for new elections, fresh elections, the ones we just had. And he tells the British people, look, I advanced it as far as I could go. But there's a roadblock in Parliament. He put it out to the people, in other words. It says Netanyahu's vision of sovereignty in Judea and Samaria and the final burial of the fake deadly peace process with the PLO is widely supported by the public. But when he set it out ahead of the last elections, it went nowhere, and for good reason. So what she explains here is that, you know, it really was a landmark speech that he gave last summer. He talked about the failure of the peace process. And what we need to do is to administer Israeli law in the Jordan Valley. That would be Judea and Samaria. Glick says if Netanyahu wants to win in March, he needs to do more than give a speech, though. Like Johnson, he needs to take practical steps to implement his vision. He needs to take steps forward, even if he runs into a roadblock down the way. She's suggesting, in other words, to take bold action and then put it to the people and see what they have to say if you reach an impasse. It says in Netanyahu's case, that means passing a government decision to apply Israeli law to those areas and dissolve the military government and civil administration. That's some serious, bold action. And she talks here in her column about how angry the reaction would be, how hostile, how deranged even the reaction would be coming from the lawyers, coming from his enemies politically. And if they were able to stop it or to slow it down, at least Netanyahu could then tell the people, the electorate, look, this is what I envisioned. This is what I intend to carry out. And they're stopping me. So now it's up to you. She's suggesting, Carolyn Glick is, that that's how he can win a majority in the March elections. She referred to, as I said, Boris Johnson's example, and then also the election of Donald Trump in 2016 and the attacks on him for these past 3 years, most recently the impeachment proceedings. And she explains, as we've explained, that this is just all an effort to take down a president they see as illegitimate. They haven't accepted the results of the 2016 election. Glick says, to win the elections and secure the work he has devoted his life to, Netanyahu needs to start treating the forces seeking his destruction as Trump does, the forces arrayed against him. So there's something she can learn from the action, the bold steps that Boris Johnson took. And there's something that he can learn from President Trump and the way that he fights against the deep state. This is from Carolyn Glick's column. Almost from the outset, she says, Trump recognized that the game against him was rigged because Trump recognizes that the campaigns against him are political, not legal. He has never accepted their legitimacy. He's never accepted it. They're the ones who are illegitimate. They are the frauds. She says he has never dignified his enemies with the respect generally shown to legal authorities and political opponents. See, he's cut from a different cloth. Usually, even when they're attacking you, you had weak Republicans that still tried to praise the enemy, sit down with and discuss plans with the enemy. President Trump's taking a different position. He's fighting the enemy from within. Listen again to what he said yesterday down in Florida. He's commenting here on all that the so-called dirty cops did to Comey, I guess. Not Comey, certainly not. Cohen, Flint, Roger, who is it? Roger Stone, there we go, not Cohen. Roger Stone. Mike Flynn, of course, the general that they took down, the FBI did. And this is President Trump referring to how unfair it all was. Clip two.
What they did to him is very unfair, in my opinion. And what they did to General Flynn is very unfair, in my opinion. And what they did to so many others is very unfair. And now we found out they're a bunch of dirty cops. And paid for by the DNC, paid for by Hillary Clinton in many cases, and in much. They did a phony dossier. They used the dossier for FISA. And now, as you know, the FISA court and your top judge is very much involved, and hopefully they're going to do something about it. But these were dirty people. These were bad people. These were evil people. And I hope that someday I'm going to consider it my greatest or one of my greatest achievements, getting rid of them. Because we have no place in our country for people like that.
That's something that you would not have heard from any of the other Republicans who ran for office in 2016. They're evil people, he said. There's no place for them in our country. Like Carolyn Glick says, from the beginning, he never accepted them as legitimate because he saw what they were doing. He saw how that they weaponized the DOJ and the FBI and the intelligence community to take down political opponents. He saw how that they were doing it all during the Obama years as well, even before the election, using the IRS to target conservative groups. He doesn't see them as legitimate. Quite the opposite. And so when you see him taking a stand where, as my father has said, others have not, it is quite something to behold. It certainly is. My father wrote in August, none of this would have seen daylight had Mr. Trump not won the election, but God wanted it exposed. Now, ultimately, what happens in March over in Israel, it's going to come down to what God wills, Romans 13 and verse 1, whether or not Netanyahu gets the majority or not. But Glick does bring up some good points about confronting the enemy, about not accepting their legitimacy when it's just a political hit job, when it's a hoax, and has been from the very beginning. That statement that I just played for you, listen to the first question coming after what he just said. These are dirty cops. These are evil people. And one of my great achievements is going to be to expose them. And then right after that, here's what some reporter asked him, clip 3.
Sir, what did President Putin say to you that convinced you that the Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election?
What did he say to me?
Yeah.
About what?
What did President Putin say to you?
You're putting words in somebody's mouth. Who are you referring to? Me? I never said anything about it. I never said a thing about it.
Her question was, what did President Putin say to you that convinced you that Ukraine meddled in the 2016 election? In other words, you're still a Russian stooge. What did he say to you to make you believe that? Never mind what the New York Times reporting said in 2017. You remember the headline, the Politico headline. The journalist that now works at the New York Times, Ukrainian efforts to sabotage Trump backfire. That's January of 2017. Yesterday, I read that Washington Post piece or paraphrased it about Vladimir Putin's continued ability to influence Trump's views. They can't let it go. And there he is. There he is right in front of them saying, I'm exposing this evil, this rot, these dirty cops. This will be my legacy. And they just, you know, brush that aside and carry right on, perpetuating the same hoax that they have from the beginning. And it's like the Steele dossier is permanently ingrained in their minds. It's engraved there. It's carved into their thinking. And there is no rooting it out. That's why they're deranged, so many of them, in their thinking, their reasoning. Carolyn Glick says, and because he has been, speaking of Trump, he's been willing to expose the nakedly political goals of his opponents. He's kept his supporters in his court and mobilized them to defend him. This is what we talked about yesterday at the end of the program. Here he's been facing this withering attack. And yet it's as strong as support for him as there has been from the beginning. Within the Republican Party, out on the campaign trail, all of these audacious attacks against him. And yet the support for President Trump is stronger than ever. She concludes here, Carolyn Glick says, by remaining on offense, despite the media's blanket support for the campaign to unseat him, Trump has successfully tarnished the reputation and the legitimacy of that campaign. Netanyahu, for his part, has been unwilling to go on the offensive against the legal fraternity. He has yet to directly confront the Attorney General or the state prosecution or the Supreme Court justices to win in March. Netanyahu needs to follow Trump's example. He needs to expose the attack. He needs to expose and attack the motives of the legal fraternity and state starkly the threat they pose to Israeli democracy. If he does, this is her opinion, but it's a pretty bold opinion. If he does, his supporters will rally around him because they will understand that his victory is the key to preserving their power as citizens in a free society. So there may indeed be some things politically that Mr. Netanyahu can learn from Donald Trump and Boris Johnson. Of course, much of this, though, has a lot to do with what God wills. So that's coming up in March, the Israeli elections. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I've said so many times, it's like coming into a movie when it's about 90-95% finished, and you don't know what went before, you don't know what events led up to what you're seeing in the movie now, and consequently you don't understand what's going on when you see the movie if you didn't see it from the beginning. The beginning always sets the foundation for the whole thing.
The beginning always sets the foundation for the whole thing. And we've gone back through Genesis 1 through 3. And even in Genesis 4, where we're introduced to Cain, we've read Genesis 4 and verse 1 recently, where Eve conceived and bare Cain. She says, I've gotten a man from the eternal, or as it says in the Companion Bible, I have gotten a man, even Jehovah. And then the society that sprung from that man, the Bible in the New Testament, later on in the Bible, nearly toward the end of the Bible, the book of Jude, it talks about the way of Cain. You can look at what happened in Genesis 4 and see that this way of life, it persisted all the way through to today. It's spread over the earth. Well, there's another way in this same chapter, the way of Abel. What a contrast. Genesis 4, verse 2, it says, and she again bare his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And so these two lads, these two brothers, some say twin brothers, they were symbols. Cain, a symbol of evil, of selfishness and vanity. And Abel, of course, became a symbol of righteousness. Verse 3, and in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Eternal. And you can study into some of the Hebrew language here to show that Cain really wasn't farming the land in a godly manner. It was very selfish and short-sighted the way he was abusing God's creation. Verse 4, and Abel he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof, and the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. So Abel, when he offered, he gave of the very best of his flock. And Cain, who was very selfish, he saw himself as righteous. I mean, he was still offering before God, but it wasn't out of a pure heart. And you see the reaction when God, who really was pleased with Abel's offering, but not with Cain, God said to Cain, verse 6, why are you wroth and why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, it's a valuable lesson here, if you do well, shall you not be accepted? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door. And unto you shall he shall be his desire, and you shall rule over him. So if you're doing well, if you're living the right way, if you're obeying God's laws, you're going to be happy. And if not, you're going to be miserable. Your countenance will fall. There may be a temporary thrill associated with the sin, but there's always a negative boomerang effect. Always. Verse 8. And Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. So he murdered his brother. He was in a jealous rage. And it resulted in the first murder. Flesh on flesh. Satan, of course, is the author of lies and murder and killing. Verse 9, it says, and the Eternal said unto Cain, where is Abel your brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? Am I supposed to look after my brother? Well, of course, if you're obeying God's law, if you're obeying the law of love, you should be. But he certainly wasn't. He didn't love his brother. He wasn't interested in protecting his brother, helping his brother. He killed his brother. He murdered his brother. Verse 10, and he said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries unto me from the ground. That's God's response. He says to Cain, look at what you've done. Even after he committed this abominable act, he didn't repent. He didn't turn to God. He wasn't remorseful. God asked him about it, and he said, well, what should I care where he is? What happened to him? I'm not his keeper. Maybe he got lost. God says, what have you done, Cain? Look at what you've done. Well, if you continue studying Genesis 4, you see God describing the dreadful results already, early on in the family, of Adam and Eve's rejection of the tree of life. Look at what happened to Cain. He was a liar. He was a murderer. A false god, in fact. And as I say, it's quite the opposite when you consider Abel. This righteous Abel. That's what God calls him elsewhere in Scripture. He was righteous. He made a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. You can read that in Hebrews 11, verses 4 and 5. His example, even though he's dead, it says over there, his example speaks. God testifies of his gifts, Abel's gifts. But with respect to this present evil world, Jude 11 is the verse I referred to earlier. It says, woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, and have ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward and perished in the gainsaying of Korah. So the whole world has just gone in the way of Cain. They've just followed in the steps of Cain, this liar, this murderer, from the very beginning. And as I say, you read through to the end of Genesis 4 and you read about the worldly society that Cain was responsible for, what he built up. Now, he agonized. He told God, my punishment's more than I can bear, and so on. But you read about the world that was in Genesis 4, and then Genesis 5, you can read some about the descendants of Seth, another one of Adam and Eve's children. And it takes you through some genealogies down through to the end of chapter 5, Enoch and Methuselah and Lamech. And then finally, at the end of chapter 5, we're introduced to Noah, whose name means comfort or rest. Now, that world just turned into, it's described in chapter 6. I guess I can just let the Bible speak for itself. Verse 5, it says, and God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. This is the way of Cain. And it had spread over the earth. Wherever there were human beings, this was the attitude. Thoughts of the hearts of men on evil continually. God looking at this thinking, what a disaster to come out from just one dysfunctional family that rejected the tree of life. Verse 12, it says, and God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. Now, there were just, I guess, about 10 generations from Adam to Noah. They lived a lot longer before the flood, as you know. But 10 generations, that's it. And God looked at it and was just shaking his head, going, how could it be this bad? How could there be this much corruption? And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me. This is verse 13. For the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. I'm going to destroy the entire human civilization. There's so much violence. There's so much evil. There's so much lust. There's so much vanity. And yet Noah himself, what a comfort. He faithfully abided by God's instructions, God's laws. He stayed the course for years, for decades, for a century, obeying God, building for God, proclaiming God's truth, a preacher of righteousness. But now think about, we read what God says about Cain in the New Testament. Remember what Jesus said about the days of Noah there in the Gospels. He said it's going to be just like it was before the flood. Right here when we get to the end of this age, the end of the present evil world. You had the antediluvian world, the world before the flood. Then you have this present evil world. And then you have the world to come, the world tomorrow. Three worlds spoken of in the Bible. And here we are at the tail end of the present evil world. Satan's time is about up. God is about to establish his family government on earth. Verse 9 of Genesis 6, it says, these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. Noah, it says, walked with God. He walked with God. He was a preacher of righteousness. He was perfect in his generations. He came from a pure line physically. Verse 1 of chapter 7, it says, and the Eternal said to Noah, come you and all your house into the ark, for you have I seen righteous before me in this generation. God viewed him as righteous. Verse 2, of every clean beast you shall take to you by sevens, the male and his female, and of the beasts that are not clean by two by two, male, female. It says of fowls also of the air by sevens, got to take the birds, and male and female, it says, and keep seed alive upon the face of all the earth. For yet 7 days I will cause it to rain upon the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and every living substance that I have made will I destroy from off the face of the earth. Every living substance, it was about to be destroyed. So God gave him these clear instructions, he and his wife, their three sons and their wives. He laid it all out. What a prophecy that would come to pass 100 years on. And so he labored year in and year out, never wavering in faith. Verse 5 says, and Noah did according unto all that the Eternal had commanded him. He followed all of the instructions right to a T, a preacher of righteousness. He's called in 2 Peter 2. And God used this faithful man, this prophet, for 100 years. Well, he used him longer than that because he lived for quite some time after the flood. But this was the 100-year period before the flood when he was building the ark and preaching for God. My father said before how that the work today is a Noah-like work. Look at the comfort that God's family will bring to this earth when his government's finally set up. Verse 11, it says, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. And so all the waters of the deep under the earth's crust broken up, and then rain from heaven, it says, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Just a deluge of rain, of flooding, nonstop, 40 days and 40 nights. And then that ark began to lift from off the ground as those water levels rose. And ultimately, the whole earth was enveloped in water. In the Epistles of Peter booklet, my father, Peter, refers back to Noah's day as well. It's mentioned a lot in the New Testament. But my father says here, Peter's use of Noah's example contains two messages. One about the destruction of an evil world, the other about a little remnant that stands up to that evil world, and is protected. Christ said this end time would be as it was in Noah's day. Man's thoughts are again on evil continually. Of course, we must give God's warning message, but there's another message of great hope for God's people. You can look at Noah's example and see that God saves a few. This is why we've been out there as God's work, visiting city after city, reaching out even to Laodiceans and telling them, look, get back right with God. Get your heart back in the work. Throw your support behind this work. And then God will back you. God will protect you even. Verse 6. Well, some of these I guess we may have read already. It says, and Noah was 600 years old when the flood waters when the flood of waters was upon the earth, and Noah went in, and his sons, and his wife, and sons' wives with him, into the ark because of the waters of the flood. And then you see the flooding, as we read earlier, verses 11 and 12. And then down in verse 20, it says, 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. So 15 cubits, or about 30 feet higher than the highest mountaintop. It says in verse 24, and the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. So for half a year, and all living creatures outside of that ark died in that flood. Chapter 8, Genesis 8, verse 3, it says, and the waters returned from off the earth continually, and after the end of 150 days, the waters were abated. So what a different world this was, where you just had, well, it was a fresh start. You had a family of eight. You had Noah as the father of the human race that would develop after the flood. He was a man of pure lineage physically, and he had upright character spiritually. So what an opportunity for his sons and for their wives and for their children to get it right. Verse 20, it says, and Noah builded an altar unto the Eternal and took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And so on the other side of the flood, it was the same attitude, the same obedience, the same service to God. And verse 1 of chapter 9, and God blessed Noah and his three sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Very similar instructions that he gave to Adam and Eve. And so they had an opportunity to do it right. But as we'll see perhaps on the next program, it didn't last for very long. The honeymoon didn't last for very long, spiritually speaking, before the world again was introduced to appalling evils, false religion, false teachings, idolatry, vanity, selfishness, that same murderous spirit, and all because Satan was still the god of this world. And what we see around us today is the culmination of that post-flood world, the present evil world, that just waxes worse and worse, as Paul said. This is the beginning of the movie. This is the foundation. This is what helps us to understand why the world is the way it is today. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with a couple of emails that we've gotten from you listeners. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is The Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Here's an email from our family listening in down in Abu Dhabi, of all places. It says, once again, the boomerang is in full swing against the leftist U.S. Democratic Party, as wholly predicted by Mr. Flurry. Now, with the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi actually abusing her power and obstructing the Senate by holding back fake articles of impeachment, of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress against President Trump. He says, nevertheless, the solution is not we the people voting current officials out of office next November, only again to be stymied by a constitutionally incompatible bureaucratic deep state. The only solution is for Jesus Christ to return in power and great glory. That comes from Abu Dhabi. This one here from Canada, it says, just wanted to say hello and let you know that you snared me into a first the other day while listening to the Trumpet Daily. I have thus far not watched one on YouTube, but the intro about the birds and the feeder compelled me to stop listening and to switch to YouTube so that I could view the birds. I have to admit, it does make a difference seeing the clips as well. So I may try to do this more often. She says, it was fascinating hearing you list off the bird names, as we have the same ones here in Canada. And recently, I just began a folder with downloaded pictures of all the birds we have encountered here thus far. We have bird feeders on our deck, and also some that hang from trees in the little wired cage. And you place a square of suet and bird seed in them, and they love it. It's been quite surprising to see how many have hung around despite the cold temperatures. So we'll continue feeding them. And of course, we have the squirrels and the chipmunks who are enjoying the free food as well. We have quite a variety of different woodpeckers as well. Well, one of the ones that I noticed this morning, it's called the pied wagtail. It's a black and white bird with a long tail, and it gets its name because it wags its tail. Surprise, surprise. I'm not sure why it's called a pied, P-I-E-D, but a pied wagtail. Look it up. Learn a little more about God's beautiful creation. Finally, it says here in this same email, keep up the bird talk for all of us nature lovers. We can see how the seasons will bring different varieties of birds. That's all we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll see you tomorrow.